Hey everyone, I'm Michael Whistler, and on this episode of Exploring Tomorrow, I have the honor of talking to Octavia Cade, author of a fantastic book called The Stone Weta. And at first I thought it was going to be about bugs, but I guess it wasn't, but don't worry, I didn't let that bug me, or something like that. Anyway, we're going to talk about climate change and climate fiction, and very much how we can use science fiction as a tool for resistance and optimism, even in the face of some very difficult challenges. So stick around. This is Exploring Tomorrow. Octavia, thank you so much for joining me for this episode and for this conversation. I got very interested in having you as a guest and checking out some of your work after hearing you on one of the panels at Flights of Foundry at the, which happened, was that April, I believe, so a couple months ago now. And it was a particularly, like, that was a particularly impactful panel for me as being someone who really believes that we can use science fiction to make the world a better place. The conversation with you and with SB Divya, who's also been on the show, around how do we portray those things and how do we deal, you know, bring in the hope punk, as it were, or even I was half jokingly referring to it as like, do we call it opti-punk? You know, how do you infuse optimism in it? And I really loved your statement about optimism and hopefulness in science fiction being very much punk, being very much an act of resistance. So very excited to have checked out your book, really enjoyed it, and very excited to chat with you. So welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Yeah, it was a great panel to be on at Flights of Foundry. And I think, too, the reason that we are seeing this sort of rise of more optimism in science fiction, the increase in emphasis on things like solar punk, is because, well, there's trends in genre, as I'm sure all of you have you know, noticed. And there has been a rather heavy emphasis on crapsack worlds, really, and dystopias for quite some time now. And don't get me wrong, I love reading dystopias and watching dystopias and all that, but there's got to be more to science fiction than misery. And so it's nice to have something that takes the genre and uses it as a tool for hope, I think, that uses it as a way to explore future-proofing options. You know, we don't know what the future is going to hold. We can hypothesize certain things. And I think science fiction is a way of exploring these possible futures. You know, is it this future that we want? What happens? What are the consequences and the knock-on effects if we do this or this or this? And so it helps us to, I think, test out possible futures before we get to them and perhaps make better decisions in advance.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it's definitely something that has really drawn me into the genre as this opportunity to run these simulations, as it were, and deal with it, which is why I understand, in a sense, the tendency in science fiction to run the simulation of, well, what happens if we end up in a dystopian scenario? What happens if the machines rise up and take over, or, you know, or comets gonna hit us, or aliens invade, or whatever the crazy cataclysmic scenario is? So I get that, and yet there, like you're pointing out, there is often a tendency, and maybe just because it's heightened conflict, there is that tendency to go down those roads. But it's fascinating to think about, well, how do we build stories that also still build optimism towards a future that that isn't strictly speaking bleak and dystopic.
Yeah, I mean, we have been living through the past sort of year and a half through a global crisis of some description. I think we're all thoroughly sick of it by now. But I also think that for many of us, especially here, I think in New Zealand, it was in some ways also a positive experience. I mean, here the country very much came together. We had one of the earliest and hardest lockdowns in the world. For about 6 weeks, everyone had to stay home entirely, pretty much. And there was very little pushback on that. It was very much, well, this is here, it sucks, let's work together to get rid of it. And all these little positive things started to happen. You know, you could go on your daily walk as long as you were, you know, around your neighborhood if you were, you know, socially distanced. And people started putting, for instance, teddy bears in their windows so that the kids could go on a bear hunt. I think there was also one thing that really interested me. A squid scientist drew a life-size model in chalk of a giant squid on the pavement outside her house and sort of left the chalk out there. If you have questions about squid, write them down on your walk, and you know, when you come back tomorrow, I'll have the answers down there for you. And I think when it comes to crisis, science fiction is very good at showing how things can fall apart, but I think in reality crisis often brings people together. And I think the increasing emphasis on solar punk or hope punk or your optipunk term is in many ways more realistic. Because, you know, people, we are a social species. We have empathy. We tend to help each other out in times of crisis. And although that isn't immediately as compelling as people, you know, getting into a gunfight over the last tin of baked beans at the supermarket, it is, it's, I think, more interesting in the long run. Yeah. You know, what do you do if there's only one tin of baked beans left? How do you work together with your neighbours to split that or to produce more food?
Yeah, yeah. I wonder, too, if there's something in that in terms of reflections on differing societal values. A lot of course, you know, the United States has had a very significant influence on the whole genre, being really the place of that, those early days of, you know, things like Astounding Magazine and John W. Campbell and those writers he fostered. And there's a level of, I wonder sometimes if the sheer individualism of our American culture is something that drives us towards telling stories where we actually fear what that radical individualism ultimately does when we hit crisis. And yet at the same time, go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say, there is a really interesting book, and I cannot remember the author, I could probably look it up for you, by an academic called Freedom Versus Fairness. He was an American academic who came to New Zealand on sabbatical and spent, you know, several years here. And he wrote the book because he came to believe that behind our two different societies were two very fundamental values. The American society was built on the value of freedom, you know, this individual freedom, do what you can, do what you like, very much that sort of thing. Whereas the New Zealand society, he argued, was built on the fundamental idea of fairness, that life should be fair, that, you know, everyone should get a fair go of things. And I think if you look at it through that way, the response to the pandemic here was very much, well, it sucks, but it sucks for all of us equally during the 6 week lockdown. So it's fair. So so we'll do it. Now, of course, fairness does, it's a nice principle, but we don't always live up to it. We seriously don't. Just as I'm sure you will argue that there are times in America where freedom has not been the the goal that has been lived up to, that you should say. But this idea that different societies have different fundamental values and how this comes out in their fiction. I mean, New Zealand often ends up in fiction, and the typical example of this is, I think, John Wyndham's The Chrysalids. This idealized place at the end of the world when it all turns to shit, there's this little island you can go to, and civilization is sort of, it's ticking away there. And it is idealized, and it's not accurate because, we have significant problems here on a number of social levels. But there is still this idea, I think, that somewhere there is this idealized place that you can go when things turn terribly. That's the experimental point of science fiction, I think. This is the future community. How is it different from what we have now, and how do we get there? So,
that makes sense. Yeah.
If you come across Freedom versus Fairness at your local library, it is a fascinating read.
That sounds fascinating. I think I'm going to have to check that out, because that's something I'm very curious about exploring and understanding, because part of my journey in science fiction and appreciating it and wanting to create it as well is wanting to bring in and just have a more global perspective. I try to do that in my own ways, have my own sort of background, actually not originally from the United States. My parents are Americans, but I spent most of my childhood in South America, in Brazil. And even just seeing how science fiction it was viewed there, and then how it's continues to be a budding and developing genre there, and recently found out about some fascinating Brazilian authors I need to go check out. And so I'm always curious about what other cultures bring to the picture, because I know I had Alec Nevila Lee on the show recently. He authored this fantastic group biography called Astounding, about L. Ron Hubbard and Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov and John W. Campbell and others. And one of the things that he talked a lot about in that book, and that we discussed in the show as well, is that pervasive individualism and that idea of the white male competent man that is such a big part of those early days of the golden age of science fiction, as it's dubbed, right? And it's fascinating to me to see that like shifted. And that was one of the things that really drew me into your book, The Stone Weta, because here we're dealing with a world where there's climate change is marching on, and it's, there's really, in essence, no interest by the powers that be to address it or do anything about it. Instead, really, there's a concerted effort to silence data and information and any studies done around this. So you set up this fascinating scenario in which various scientists, and as it happens in your story, all women, so not the competent white male, but all women of various nationalities and backgrounds, who are, take it upon themselves to kind of step into some secret espionage, almost kind of intrigue here, to protect valuable information about how climate is changing, how it's affecting the various, their particular areas of expertise. So they're from various disciplines. Hopefully I'm doing justice to sort of explaining your book. I found it really fascinating, and I'd love to hear what was the inception of this idea for you?
News stories. You talk about it, and I've seen some other reviewers say, this future where data is being controlled, and it's not the future, it's actually happening now. a couple of years ago, it came out that big oil, the major oil companies, had known about climate change for decades and had sat on information because it was more important to them to keep running their business and keep making money than it was to, you know, be scientifically accurate or be truthful and you know, work for the environment. And every little detail in the Stoneweta, from people complaining about, you know, when they're trying to get their journal articles published, that they're accepted as long as they change the keywords so that the keywords don't include climate change. I saw a scientist complaining about that because it had happened to her. The idea of people no longer being allowed to attend conferences to talk about climate change. News article in Scientific American about that happening to American researchers. All these details are things that are actually happening. I mean, we think of science as this objective process where all information is shared, but it isn't. Science is political. And I don't particularly enjoy saying that because, you know, as a scientist myself, we like this ideal of science being somehow separate, but it isn't, because science is practiced by people and people are political. And it's also funded by political agencies, by governments and companies and universities who all have their own agendas. And so the practice of science is really compromised in a number of different ways. And what really, so I was, you know, being a science communicator and a scientist myself, I just stored up these things every time I saw them and stuck them in a little folder on my computer. And then I saw a story, I think it was back in 2016, about data archivists who were archiving climate data across borders in the face of, I think, the 2016 US election, because they were afraid that the Environmental Protection Agency and so on would be gutted, that a lot of the climate data that was previously available would be removed from you know, public access. And so they started saving this data and storing it, you know, not in the United States, for instance. Right. And it's not just the US that does this. Australia has a fairly recent history of it too, especially with the Great Barrier Reef and trying to suppress information about what is going on there, keeping it out of UN reports on climate change, for instance. And so when I wrote the original short story, because this was a short story, the first chapter of the book is a short story that appeared in Clark's World. And so when I wrote that, that was the inspiration for it. And when I decided to, you know, just keep going, it was because this is a subject that, you know, is really quite important to me as a science communicator. Communicating science and communicating the problems of science is basically the reason for my existence as a science communicator. You know, this is what needs to be done. These are the issues I think we should be talking about, that people should be made aware of. So science and politics, the connection between them is just something I find absolutely fascinating.
Yeah,
absolutely. In a slightly terrifying way.
yeah, I'm with you there. Very terrifying. Yeah, because I not as I guess aware of all those things that you're talking about, but definitely have read. I was thinking of a book called Free Radicals, sort of tracing a history of sort of the scientific process, and in it the author does talk about, you know, the current trend of the need to kind of. Don't be too alarmist in your papers if you want to, like, keep getting your funding, you know, and those kinds of things. And so, you know, I have family that are, you know, more conservative leaning and do tend to question sometimes some of these things. And I've gathered this sense from them of this, like, oh, there's some sort of broader conspiracy, or not maybe not formal conspiracy, but just bias and agenda by scientists to be alarmist. And then I read things like that and I'm like, no, it sounds to me like if anything, there's a pressure on scientists to not be as alarmist as they maybe should be. Yeah. Because they need to keep their jobs. And so if you're going to keep your lab funded and you, all the people that you employ, keep income for them, then maybe this is time to be as alarmist.
This is one of the issues that I talk about in the Stone Wetter in the chapter on bristlecone pine, which sounds a bit odd. For those of you who haven't read the book, all these scientists have a code name that relates to a plant or animal that they are studying. And bristlecone pine is a replacement for a scientist who just disappeared. And she sort of has to make a choice, you know, how much does she want to get involved within this sort of espionage, and how much does she want to protect data, because it is her remit as a scientist to spread and protect data, but she has to eat and you know she's got financial problems, and you know it's not easy to get a job in a university research environment, and she's just managed to scrape one in because her work is removed enough from climate to make her a safe bet. And so she gets her job and she can make waves and potentially lose that job, or she can just keep her head down and you know, try to protect herself. And this is a valid option because scientists have to make this choice all the time. I think one of the other panels I was on at Flights of Foundry was on, I think, sort of mad scientists and ethics and science. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to a couple of other scientists there, and they were talking about how, you know, they were in the health sciences and human biology and neuroscience. And they were talking about how they got ethics training, which is great. You know, I am all for that. But I came through botany and marine science, and we didn't get any.
I remember you mentioning that.
The chemists didn't get any. The geologists don't get any. And if you're a chemist or a geologist, one of your major pipelines for employment is to the oil companies. And so what happens to you when you have to... The only way to sort of keep food on the table and to practice this in this field that you love is to do something so damaging to the environment. Right. I mean, how do you do that? What choices do you make? Because all that information that these oil companies had, that they basically sat on, this was scientists coming up with this information, scientists working for the oil companies. And it must have been an extremely difficult choice for some of them, but it's not something we really talk about.
Oh, for sure. Because that is something that is easy to forget sometimes for those of us who are not scientists and don't live that reality and understand those challenging choices that have to be made, you know, but it's ultimately a very human reality, right? When we have to make that choice between preserving ourselves and our livelihood and being truthful and honest with the data in the face of what can be very major pressures, clearly. And it's not like these things are unprecedented, you know, like, there's a clear history of industry hiding things. If we just look back at the tobacco industry, asbestos, and all these various things that were, it just was not in the interest of for-profit industry to admit, oh, the science shows this is all a bad idea.
Yeah, and the thing is, from right when you go into, you know, university, when you're starting your scientific career, there's no training for this. I mean, unless you're going, you know, through the sort of the medical sciences, the human biology, there's no training. There is no help for you. There is no preparation for these issues. And I think what I wanted to see in the Stone Wetter was people grappling with these issues, because they are important and they are happening. And I wanted to see people grapple with them and not compromise. Because we're talking about, you know, how you know, science fiction can show a better future. I think one of the necessities for that better future is for scientists to stand by their work, to say, you know, no, I will not be silenced. I will not compromise my research. And that's a big ask.
Right.
Because the consequences are far more personal there. I mean, if a scientist is fired for being too outspoken, for instance, the consequences are falling on them. It's them that has to go out and find a way to pay the mortgage and to keep food on their children's tables. Everyone else can just go back to their normal lives. You know, they're not paying the price for this. So it's a big ask to ask people to do this. And that's what I wanted to explore, how people can start to do this and sort of balance the consequences to themselves. Because all the scientists in the Stone Wetter, they're all from different countries. Most of them are women of colour because, well, for two reasons. Basically because the impacts of climate change fall disproportionately on people of colour, and within that population, they fall more on women of colour than men of colour. And also because women in science more often go overlooked. And if you are looking to, you know, do something threatening in the background, you want it done by people who are competent at not being noticed, mm-hmm. who have experience in, I think, in navigating these more difficult waters. And so I think it was interesting to make women the entire center of this novel, because, you know, these are their lived experiences.
Yeah, I love that choice, and I found it really fascinating. As I was reading, I was like, why does it seem to be only women? But slowly the unraveling of that reality, and it gets discussed even in the book, of that nature that of the beast, as it were, that, yeah, for our society and our cultures tend to, because of such a powerful patriarchal influence, we tend to overlook women or more easily push them aside or assume that they may be subservient in some way. And here these women are actually weaponizing that in a positive way.
And I love that they're weaponizing it. You want to push us in the background? Fine. You just watch what's happening in the foreground while we, you know, sort things out back here. I think you were talking before about the sort of golden age of science fiction, which always makes me slightly roll my eyes because, to be honest, I think the golden age is now. These are the interesting stories for me. But you're talking about these sort of individual white male heroes working sort of off on their own. And not only does that not particularly interest me, it's also really not reflective of science. I mean, science is a communal practice these days. There is no longer really space for the Dr. Frankenstein figure working, you know, isolated in his lab in the middle of nowhere where no one knows what he's doing. So I really liked having the heroes of this book being women working together rather than, you know, someone off doing his own thing, because there is something about that sort of isolated hero figure which is comforting in all the wrong ways. Mm. It says that, you know, you can keep going and doing what you're doing because someone else will fix it. Someone else will come up with this technological marvel. That means all the consequences of our choices will be taken away from us. You know, it's not enough to look at how we distribute food in the world, how, you know, some countries hoard it and other countries starve. You know, that's fine as long as someone else comes up with this magic replicator that allows us to, you know, press a button and get a chocolate sundae. That's the kind of technological fix which really doesn't interest me at all in science fiction, because it gives people space not to grapple with the real issues, which are things like exploitation and things like that. How do we justify living in a world where people are starving? we can't really justify it. And if we rely on this outside heroic individual figure to come and fix everything, it takes attention away from our own complicity in the problems that are affecting people today. So I am far more interested in communal solutions to problems in science fiction. And that's what I think the sort of hope punk and solar punk does really well. It's a focus on sort of community, on social ecology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's, and I'm excited to see more of that and to see, like, you know, these kinds of stories develop, because I think that it's an interesting challenge. Like I get why it's easier in some ways to use the competent man framework, because you've got a single character, they can be very proactive, and you can just, like, the story almost writes itself, right? You just plug in your three-act structure, your hero's journey, whatever, and blah, 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 boom. You got, like, basically all your story beats, and you can just crank it out. It is more challenging to think about, okay, well, how do I build a communal story that isn't about a single heroic character, you know? So I love when I come across these stories, and I love, like, hearing you talk about this, because I think it's really important, especially for people interested in creating science fiction, but even for fans of science fiction, to seek those kinds of stories out and support them, elevate them, celebrate them, recommend them to more people. Because while I enjoy books like Project Hail Mary, you know, Andy Weir's book that just came out, I read it, reviewed it, overall enjoyed it, and yet, you know, I find it falls neatly into that competent man category. It is just a sort of updating of, you know, golden age science fiction, and it has its merits and it has its purpose. And at the same time, though, I don't want that to be the only kind of science fiction that exists. And I think that in many regards, while that's, like, stories like that are really entertaining, stories like the Stone Weta and more thoughtful, broad-reaching, inclusive science fiction are the ones that are going to be more important in the long run for us.
Yeah. I'd like to say yes to that, simply because that's the kind of stuff that I'm writing. It would be nice to think that I'm producing important work, but...
I would say you are. I mean, it's a nuanced and fascinating book that I hope more people will read, you know? I don't know what kind of reception you've gotten from readers so far.
Fairly good, which is nice. The thing is, with something like The Stone Witch, I don't want to sort of replace all these stories about, you know, this basically superhero tech figure coming in to fix anything, because those stories have, you know, value too. Mm-hmm. I think they do give people hope, and I'm, when it comes to creating a future world that people can be excited about, that people can look forward to and find the positive in, I don't think you can build that in any one prescriptive way. I think, you know, you've got to reach people in a number of different ways, because different things appeal to different people, mm-hmm. which is one of the things we really learned in science communication. Some people respond really well to graphs and tables, and, you know, some people need a story. Yeah. And it doesn't matter. One is no better or no more useful than the other. You've just got to find all the different ways you can to reach people. Mm-hmm. And so I think this sort of sole superhero figure does have value. Right. It certainly does, but I also think that the sort of community ideal of books like The Stone Weta and a lot of, say, solar punk books have value as well in a different way, and they will appeal to, I think, different people, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Yeah, like I said, I don't want it to be the only kind of story. I enjoy those in their own right, but yeah, I think there's great value in expanding our horizons, I think, in a lot of ways. And what I appreciated about The Stone Weta was the way in which it interweaved these different stories together and fleshed out, I think, a lot of the the personal sacrifice that each of the scientists had to make along the way, and the tension that they had to live in, which is really, like, it's a vivid thing to think about, what they're sacrificing. Have you, I'm just like curious, like, have you heard from any scientists who have maybe checked out the book and have been like, ooh, like, this, like, hits kind of close to home?
I haven't heard from any scientists who have said, you know, this has happened to me. Mm-hmm. But I have heard from a few who find it recognizable, shall we say, mm-hmm. which is unfortunate. Right. I mean, it's great that I'm, you know, reflecting reality in some way, but it's an extremely unfortunate reality. So there is that. I think too, what I've noticed is that it's a lot of people seem to see it as almost more short stories strung together, because mm-hmm. it's not a typically linear novel. I think maybe 10 chapters, each one of them focuses on one of these scientists and this resistance. And it gives them a little problem, it gets them to the end of it, and then it shifts on to the next scientist, and it doesn't come back. Mm-hmm. And what this does is that it focuses very much on this idea of community, but it also allows sort of for layering. Mm-hmm. You can see reflected in, you know, a particular chapter problems of an earlier one approached from a different way. Because I thought it was really important that, you know, these scientists disagree on a number of points. I mean, do they engage in violence, for instance? Do right. they not? That's one of the central arguments among them. And, you know, just because they're working on this project together doesn't mean that they're all in lockstep, because they aren't.
Right. You've got a big diversity in cultural and even religious and ethical backgrounds that come to play to that, which I think is a really important and fascinating conversation in and of itself, because of its humanness and its reality and importance as we go forward.
Yeah, well, I'm particularly interested in, you know, encouraging women in science and people of colour in science, especially women of colour. And so I think that's why there was so much focus on that in this book, because science is a global endeavour. Mm-hmm. It's something that touches everyone, that can be practised by everyone, that should be practised by everyone, because when your science is only practised by one type of person, that's when you get things like the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, mm-hmm. which a miserable piece of scientific history.
Right.
That if you don't know about, you should probably go look it up, because it's fundamental to how ethics and science needs to be, you know, right at the center of the practice of science, and what happens when science is so undiverse that you begin to see the practice of science in terms of outgroups.
Yeah.
You know, who can be experimented on, who can't be. It's terrible. So we need many more types of people in science, I think. Both working in science and being represented as working in science and novels and short stories and all of that.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, for listeners, if you're curious about that, that experiment, the Tuskegee experiment, I believe John Oliver on Last Week Tonight just recently discussed that as a key important reason why within the United States there's a history of mistrust within African Americans around, do I really go to the doctor or not? And it stems directly from this unethical testing done on the Black community as used as guinea pigs, and it just check it out.
It wasn't a short-term experiment. It went on for 40 years, four decades. That is two generations of corrupt scientists doing this experiment, and not only taking part in it, but going on from that experiment to be deans of medical schools and teaching a new generation of the science that they practiced. So the ripple effects throughout the profession, I think, from things like Tuskegee are profound, and they're not explored as well as they could be. Yeah. And when they are explored within the realms of medicine, generally. Mm-hmm. They're not taken to the chemists or the geologists or the botanists. I mean, it's something we need to look at more. And when we talk about, you know, using science fiction to future-proof our societies, to basically hypothesize and test out different possible futures, we need at the center of those futures, or at least, you know, substantially further in than the periphery, scientists to put ethics at the very heart of their practice of science. And I think that is itself a sort of positive depiction of the future, because it's something that we don't always have now.
Right. Do you think that there's a possibility of something like a more generalized Hippocratic oath for scientists that should come about?
Well, that's an interesting idea, isn't it? I haven't thought of that before. All I've thought of so far is, you know, getting ethics into universities and as, you know, necessary compulsory parts of, you know, science degrees, but a generalized Hippocratic oath, that's something to look at. Right. I think it's my next story.
Hey, cool. Please run with it. I'd love to read that. Just, you know, because, you know, just as I think about, like, you know, the weight and the impact that scientists can and do have on our world. And it's not always like, you know, a big, massive global impact necessarily, but there is impact. I mean, I think of even, this is not science fiction, unfortunately, it's very much reality right in my state, where there was two drug lab scientists who were doctoring tests and we're actually getting high off of the drugs they're testing, which determine whether or not someone could be properly prosecuted for possessing those drugs or not. In fact, there's a whole docuseries on Netflix about it, you know, and that's just an example of the crumbling or maybe the lack of ethics in that scenario, and the fact that there were no, you know, it's easy to blame the individual in that scenario, but when, as I watched the docuseries and really dove into understanding that situation, what I was struck by was just how systemic the problem really was, and how ethics never really seemed to enter the conversation properly until at least a couple of defense attorneys finally say, hey, hang on a second. How is this ethical to keep sending my clients to prison when the person who did the test that determined whether or not my client is even worthy to stand trial, let alone go to prison, it was high
on those drugs. You cannot rely on conclusions from compromised data. Mm-hmm. And that is something that really is at the heart of science communication. Because if you do not communicate science successfully to the general public, if you make it complicated, well, you cannot make it simple. You cannot, you know, go out and say this and this and this, because there is uncertainty built into science. But if you make it so unreliable that no one can trust it, if your scientists are compromised so that no one can trust their data or their conclusions, I mean, look at Andrew Wakefield with the vaccines cause autism movement.
Just read look a book at how on much him. It's,
look at how much that has spread, that idea that vaccines cause autism. It's everyone has heard that. It is everyone. And if you make data so compromised in that way, then you not only undermine people's understanding of that particular science, but you also contribute to distrust for science in general, which is what you were talking about with African-American populations. Very reasonably, very rationally saying, you know, we do not trust this system that has exploited us for so long. That is the rational response, but is not the response that you need for a... It is not the response that you want if you are trying to produce a literate, science-literate society. Because when you have an entire section of population that has rational distrust for science, then science has failed that society. And the scientists practicing that science have failed that society. And that's how you end up with lots of people going unvaccinated because vaccines cause autism. That's how you end up with intelligent design and science classes, even though there is nothing that can be tested on that hypothesis.
Nothing's falsified.
Science is a methodical process of testing. If you cannot build an experiment to test something, it does not belong in the science classroom. But, you know, people who are not literate in science or who are literate in science and have come to distrust it for a variety of extremely rational reasons, that does not contribute to this sort of positive future that, you know, books like mine are hoping to produce. Some of them anyway. Some of them are pretty grim.
right. Some are grim. Work as cautionary tales. And I love a good cautionary tale. I think it's valuable in its own right. But I do think that there is a real sense in, I guess maybe I just, you know, as I age and I have a daughter and I think about the future and the world we're leaving to our children and their children, you know, there's this weight of responsibility as a storyteller that I feel around... even this notion that if we can't first picture it and imagine it, then how the hell do we expect to build it? How do we expect to accomplish it?
I think we have to use imagination to idealize a future. I mean, this idea of utopia that people have, I mean, utopia is different for everyone. Some people build up this idealized dream of a future, which would be a nightmare for me. And I'm sure my idea of utopia would be equally horrible for some. But unless you can visualize the future, you can never build it. I mean, I might have mentioned in that sort of Foundry panel, the idea of the public library as a piece of utopian futurism, because, you know, way back when there were no public libraries, it must have seemed a ridiculously pie-in-the-sky idea that there could be a building full of books that would be bought by, you know, local government or whoever, and you could just go and take them for free and then go and give them back. And people must have thought, who is going to pay for this? How can you possibly imagine that once people have these books, they will bring them back? People don't share. You know, they'll just steal them, all the books. And besides, the people who use the public library don't really need to read anyway. I mean, you can just see all the miserable, petty arguments against this. And it turns out that they are some of the most, you know, fundamental necessary parts of a community. And it's not just books at the public library anymore. You know, it's reading lessons and, you know, financial literacy lessons. And I was in my own little local public library a couple of months ago, and I was just typing away so as not to be typing at home for, you know, a change of scenery.
I feel that.
And over in one corner was this elderly man sounding out a picture book on insects to another man who was helping him learn to read. I mean, that is what the public library is for. That's an extremely idealistic building. And there was a time when people would have thought it just beyond incomprehensible that it could work. But because people could imagine it working, they were able to implement it. And I think that's what science fiction could be particularly good at doing. It can imagine. Even if it's not an entire future, it can imagine a single part of a future, one tiny part, this building where people can go for stories.
Yeah.
And I think often in science fiction, we look to create this massive global future where everything is perfect. And you can't do that because perfect is different for everyone. You can imagine, I think, however, one tiny part of that future and make an argument for that, just as people, you know, hundreds of years ago made an argument for the public library. And I think that's where the real success of science fiction is going to lie. This small improvements that people can understand and imagine and get behind as something that can be done for them in their community.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, just listening to you talk about that even just makes me think, do we someday look back and say the same thing about universal basic income or some of these other concepts that right now people would be like, no, that'll never work. I wonder, you know, and that's why I think it's such a valuable thing in science fiction. And actually, speaking of just the value of science fiction and all that, I'm always curious to hear from folks, what brought you to science fiction in the first place? Like, what was that first spark for you?
My parents are both big fans of science fiction and fantasy. So the first book I can really ever remember reading, I think, was The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. Mm-hmm. I was given it for Christmas when I was 4. And it's my first real sort of reading memory, reading through this book while Mum was vacuuming up tinsel around me. But that was fantasy. For science fiction, it would be Star Trek. Mm-hmm. Like many, many other people. Yeah. And I think many, many other scientists. My mum especially was particularly into Star Trek. She made sure that my sister and I saw it from when we were very young, because she used to watch it as a child too. She had to sort of sneak watch it because apparently Mr. Spock reminded Nana of Satan.
Oh no. Nicest depiction of Satan I've ever seen, but okay.
Yeah. So yeah, when you know, the next generation came out, Mum was right, pack your shit up, we're going to the video store. We are getting this and you're gonna sit through it.
Nice. Oh, that's awesome. That's great. And you know, a moment ago too, you mentioned this idea of scientific literacy being such a valuable and important thing. I know you're scientists as well. What do you see is the role of science fiction in terms of promoting scientific literacy?
Well, when I was talking before about the different ways to approach scientific communication, science communication, science fiction can do that. It can teach people about science. I mean, we are a species that relies on stories. We are trained on stories. We're raised up from them, from we're very small. And, you know, our parents are telling us nursery rhymes and fairy tales. Right. We learn through stories, and we can teach science through stories. And if we can, then that is a valuable way of, you know, getting people to learn about science. And I will take, you know, whatever it takes to make people learn about science, I mean, I am all for it. Some people don't like science fiction, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. They can, you know, read popular science or go and see a documentary. Or, you know, just follow scientists on Twitter and ask them questions. Or, you know, buy a slime kit, as I did for my nephew last Christmas, to my sister's great delight.
I love those kits.
Yeah. I think when it comes to teaching people about anything, not just science, about anything. You have to be open-minded as to the ways that they can approach it. You have to make it appealing to them, because people don't learn what they're not interested in. And science fiction is a great way of making science appealing, making the practice of science appealing. So I think that's really useful and really interesting to me anyway, because that was how I learned it.
Yeah. No, that's wonderful. That makes so much sense. And that's, you know, certainly one thing that I will say, like, even like of Andy Weir's stories, while, you know, while they fit into that sort of competent man kind of category, there is this elevation of how do I think critically? How do I problem solve? And how do I use the scientific method in such a way where I actually arrive at a viable solution?
Yeah.
You know, which is very...
Because so much of science is failure.
It is, exactly.
And, you know...
Well, so much of life is failure.
The practice of science. And it's a good thing.
Yeah.
I mean, we often learn a lot more from a failed experiment than we do from an experiment that's gone well.
Yeah. And it probably is a bigger conversation there culturally that... I think especially within the American context of... our propensity to be uncomfortable with failure and therefore to not grasp and understand the important progress that is made in science with every single failure, and that actually every failure represents data, it represents progress, it represents new understanding, because those are, you know, bits of information that we did not have prior to that supposed failure.
Yeah. Failure is a good thing. I mean, overall, it's hurtful sometimes and we don't like to do it, but but generally if you don't fail, you don't grow. Mm-hmm. And that's true for every aspect of life, not just science.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I can't help thinking of Mythbusters and their motto, yeah, of failure is always an option. Yeah.
And Mythbusters is a great show.
Yes. We're addicted to it here. Even though it's off the air, we're still like, we go through and we watch it with our 7-year-old daughter because it's just too much fun. Actually, she was literally just watching an episode earlier, just before I hopped on here. And I value that, and as again another way of communicating science, right, and communicating, yeah, that sort of scientific thinking, which I think is, I mean, if this pandemic has taught me anything, it is just how challenging it is for so many people to understand and actually wrap their minds around the scientific process and progress. You know, so people, as a friend pointed out to me, you know, even in discussions around, oh, the vaccine, you know, are they really going to be that great? Or is it going to be really that effective? And a friend pointed out, like, well, do you think we didn't make any progress on vaccines in the past couple of decades? You know, do you think we didn't make any progress in that area of science? Like, obviously we have. And that's just true across the board. And also just understanding risk mitigation, that nothing is, yeah, zero risk, 0%. Literally nothing is. I find that to be just really enlightening, but also kind of depressing. And as a fellow science fiction storyteller, like I'm grappling with, like, how do I turn that into something positive and like communicate that with the world?
Yeah. How do we get people to stop saying it's only a theory?
Yes. Oh, God, I hate that so much.
Yeah.
Fundamental misunderstanding what that word means.
Yeah, it'd be nice to be able to, you know, wave a magic wand and have everyone literate in science, but it doesn't work like that. And to be honest, scientists have only themselves to blame. the communication of science for generations has been through the scientific paper, basically. It's how scientists communicate with each other. And it is the most unwelcoming, unreadable form of communication that may have ever been invented. I mean, I don't know how many of you have ever had to read scientific papers, but they suck the joy and wonder out of science. And they do it deliberately. And from the moment you step foot in science lab and, you know, biology 101 or whatever you're doing at university, you are taught to strip all that joy and wonder and excitement and exploration from your communication of science. And really, is it any wonder that parents who are wondering whether they should vaccinate their children go on the internet looking for something to that they can understand? Because of course they are. People don't make decisions like that because they want to hurt their children.
No.
They're going out to do the best that they can with the information that is provided for them. And if the primary information is so unreadable and so unbearable, then obviously they are going to go out and look elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And I think if one of the stories I've had published in the past year is scientists after a pandemic that, you know, wipes out pretty much everyone. We, you know, it's one of these rebuild the world stories. And my scientists say, look, we're in the aftermath of the apocalypse. What do we do? Let's rebuild academic publishing in a better way, because, you know, this is their priority. And they do. That's the story about how they rebuild scientific papers to make them readable for the general public. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something we need to look at. I mean, if we're talking about the future tiny thing, the new public library of science fiction, mm-hmm. That is something I would like to see come true. You know, readable primary research that can be read and understood by everyone. Because right now we don't have it, and the consequences of that have been enormous, because people don't understand science, and it's the fault of the scientists because they don't communicate it well enough.
Talk about casting a vision.
I
like that. Certainly, I think a big challenge. I mean, I can relate to it. I studied philosophy in college, and you know,
it's the only thing worse than science.
Right.
Yeah. The readability.
Yes, the readability of your average philosophy, even undergraduate philosophy paper, is a nightmare.
Then you take something like Sophie's World by, I think, Justin Garber, and look at how popular that was, how many, you know, millions of copies have sold. It's not that people aren't interested in philosophy. It's not that they don't want to learn about it.
Right.
It's mm-hmm. that it's so unreadable that, you know, it's hard for them to get to encompass. And when something, you know, comes along that they can engage with, they do.
Right.
People like to learn things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is something that is at least encouraging to me, you know, that when we learn to communicate in a way that is engaging, and actively invites people in, a lot of great things can happen.
I think, you know, that is one of those future positives that we hope for, isn't it? That, you know, people get involved, that they are engaged. And I think people want to be. I mean, that's a fundamentally optimistic view, I think, but no one wants to be ignorant. No one wants to, you know, live in squalor when they could have better. We make it hard for people to engage with intellect. Like it's, I don't want to say it's popular to be stupid, but there is a certain streak of anti-intellectualism that is becoming more and more apparent in more and more of our societies, including mine. And that is because I think intellectual pursuits such as science and philosophy have been associated with such academic snobbery that they have kind of earned a certain level of disdain, because if you treat the general public with disdain, mm-hmm. you know, you're too stupid to understand my research, then of course they're going to mirror it back to you. Of course they are. Mm-hmm. I know we're probably running out of time, but a quick example here. Back when I was first gone to grad school, I did an internship with Cosmos Magazine, which is Australasia's biggest popular science magazine. And one of the things I had to do was to ring up researchers to talk about their work, so we could have little précis, you know, in the magazine of what these people were doing. And there was one person who shall remain nameless, who pretty much was extremely disinterested in talking to us. They pretty much said, look, this is too complicated for you to understand. You know, your readers won't get it. You know, I mean, I can do it if you want to. And I sort of put the phone down and I went to the editor and I told him what had happened. And he said pretty much, well, fuck him. We don't need to talk about their research. And so we didn't, you know, no article got written on this particular piece of research, mm-hmm. which is not only, you know, bad for people who might have been interested in the subject matter. And I'm being quite, you know, ambiguous as to what that is, because, you know, let's not point fingers here when we don't have to, but it's also bad for the researcher because, you know, they could have had their work published. They could have engaged with the general public. And, you know, when the time comes around for them to get more funding, the lack of popular interest in their work is going to impact on how much funding they have.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And whatever happened to the notion of, if you can't explain it to a child, then you probably don't know it well enough.
Yeah, well, Ernest Rutherford, who is, you know, one of my scientific heroes, he's a New Zealander, he split the atom, this guy to split the atom. He used to say that if you can't explain your experiment to a barmaid, then you don't understand what you're doing. And it's not because he thought barmaids were stupid, but because he didn't. Mm-hmm. It was because he thought that, you know, if you can't explain your experiment in a way that non-scientists can understand, then, you know, it's not clear enough in your own mind.
Right. Yeah, seriously. It's been an absolute pleasure getting to chat with you about all this. I mean, we could probably keep exploring this deeper and deeper, but I also want to, you know, give people an opportunity to just learn more about you and your work. Where can we check out more information about you, maybe get our hands on the Stone Weta or some of your other work?
I have a website, ojcade.com, and I'm also on Twitter at ojcade. So yeah, pretty much there. Twitter's really my only social media.
Yeah, that's fine. That's good. Yeah. Are you working on anything new aside from academic work?
Yeah. In a couple of weeks, I'm off to a short residence, writer's residency in Auckland, one of the Michael King residencies. And there I am working on, you remember I was just telling you about that the short story about rewriting academic publishing after the apocalypse. I'm working on a collection of short stories about that there.
Nice. Good. Yeah. I think that's a valuable picture to paint, or a simulation to run. It's something we need to picture and make happen.
Yeah. So that's going to be fun. That's
wonderful.
That's my next project.
That's great. That's wonderful. And do you have happen to have any recommendations of other science fiction, whether movies or books or short stories that you have found just really praiseworthy, really, that you want more people to check out?
Well, this is probably going to sound bad because I'm in it, but recently there's been a book come out from World Weaver Press called Multi-Species Cities. I should have thought to drag it out.
Oh, if you want to grab it, that's okay.
I can't remember where it is. There's a lot of books in this room. but anyway, it's a solar punk book, and it was developed in association with the Institute for Humanity and Nature in Kyoto in Japan. And what it is, it's a short story collection, well, anthology, about future cities and how they can be reimagined to house different sorts of life. Basically a collection about urban ecology. And so I think that's really interesting because it is that solar punk ideal, you know, how can we make our communities more sustainable, more diverse? And when they wrote to me to ask, you know, would you like to contribute a story to this? Very happily, I had just read, you know, not very long before, about something that had happened in Wellington, which is that capital city here in New Zealand. Scientists going into the stormwater system pipes had found that they were being colonized by eels and fish. Hmm. And I thought that was just lovely. And they were thinking, you know, there are ways to encourage this colonization when the pipes need to be replaced, because obviously it's not economically feasible to rip out an entire stormwater system and replace it. But, you know, every so often, bits of that system need replacing. So you can replace them with pipes that have a rough surface inside, because that slows the water down and makes it easier to swim. You can replace them with pipes that have a deeper bottom, so that bigger fish can use them to swim. You can put in little shelters so that, you know, the eels and the fish have something to rest behind, as they would behind, say, a rock in a stream. So these are all small things that you can do to encourage sustainability and biodiversity within an urban environment. So Multi-Species Cities is stuffed with stories like that. And I think it's just a fascinating project. I was so happy to be part of it.
That does sound fascinating. Definitely going to have to check that out. That sounds wonderful. Yeah. Well, Octavia, thank you so much for taking time to chat with me today and just dive into some of these topics and keep up the great work. Both as a science communicator and writing books, I think it's really important and valuable, and has it has an important impact in our world, and hopefully more scientists are thinking as along these lines as well, and hopefully more of us storytellers can band together and continue to think about how do we tell the story, how do we promote that scientific literacy, and promote a better picture of tomorrow. So I really appreciate it's been fascinating. I've learned a lot just in the last hour. So I appreciate you doing this.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm so happy to see a program that focuses on the positive future of science fiction. So I'm excited to see more of it in the future.
Well, thank you so much. Holy cow. I absolutely loved that conversation with Octavia Cade. Really fascinating. Learned a lot just in the last hour or so. And so my huge thanks to Octavia Cade for being on the show and just for writing such a wonderful book. So I really do encourage you to check out The Stone Weta. It's a very different kind of novel. It's very meditative on these just the realities that these characters are wrestling with. And as you heard in Octavia talking about, it's really all too close to reality in a lot of ways, and thus makes it all the more important for us to understand and read and grapple with as we think about what we are asking or even imposing on scientists. And So I encourage you to check that out. I really enjoyed it. Very worthwhile. And check out some of her other work. I've got to check out the anthology that she mentioned. That sounded absolutely fascinating to me. So in the meantime, please continue to take care of yourself. And actually, if it's not obvious at all from, especially even this last episode, please get vaccinated. I've got both vaccines. It's been great to get back out. I'm taking my wife on a date this weekend to celebrate her birthday. We actually get to go out to a restaurant we haven't been to in ages, get to actually go to a movie theater, gasp. Things we can do because thank God for scientists and vaccines. So please take good care of yourself and each other, and continue to ask big questions and dream big and picture a brighter tomorrow. Thank you so much for watching. We'll see you soon.